Vibe tribes. Welcome back, people, to another episode of Vibes and Tribes. With me, your host Baze. It's been a while, folks. Apologies for the delay in getting out another episode to you, but we're back. And as Bryson Tiller would say, hopefully we're better. So, with that, I'm your host, Baze. Welcome to Vibes and Tribes. For those of you who have listened before, and for those of you listening for the first time, this is a podcast where, you know, we talk to really interesting people and just understand their pathway in interesting careers. So today I'm joined by none other than my good friend Carmen. So Carmen, don't know if you want to just quickly introduce yourself and your job title, and then we'll get into it.
Thanks for having me on the show, Bio. I'm Carmen, and currently the CMO of Alchemy Pay, which is a crypto payment platform. Prior to that, I was running my own consultancy called Another Startup Story. And prior to that, I was working in a creative agency as the FC. So had quite a few different twists and turns in my career.
We're gonna unpack all of that today. Before we start, though, please, guys, make sure you like, subscribe, share the love, comment at vibesandtribes_. We'll put it in the notes. But with that, let's take it way, 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 way back, as we do on this pod. And we'll start with your secondary education. So where is it you went, Carmen?
For secondary school, yeah. I went to Thorndon.
Thorndon.
Chandlesford, a little town called Chandlesford down south.
Okay, down south. And what were your initial memories of your secondary school experience?
Secondary school experience, I was always very creative. I loved graphic design and like dance and acting. It was like, those were like the kind of subjects that I enjoyed, mm-hmm. but also appreciated needing to get good grades, you know, being Asian, like getting good grades in all the core, you know, science, English, maths. But I think when I look back, I was always really fond of, more creative sessions.
And I suppose with that in mind, when it came to, I suppose, choosing your GCSEs, did you pick those with A-levels in university in mind, or did you just pick what you were passionate about at the time?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, it's probably more important to look at A-levels. So I chose maths, economics, psychology, and graphics. And so those were the kind of like safe top. I think the economics and the maths was very safe. Like, I knew I wanted to do something to do with business. But then I also liked the creative side, so I picked graphics. But I went to quite an academic college. I went to Peter Simmons in Winchester. Okay. And the graphics there was not what I imagined. It was basically woodwork and just like plastics and a lot more kind of practical.
What is it you imagined? What is it you thought it was going to be?
So it was more product design. So, okay. Yeah, playing with plastics and woodwork. And I was basically the only girl in my class. Nothing wrong with that. But I just, I thought it would be a lot more kind of graphic design. So designing, like, you know, a lot more branding and marketing and visual identity, that kind of stuff. But, definitely was not that. So I basically dropped that after my first year and then continued on with economics, maths and psychology.
Great. And how did you find them? How did you find the subjects? Did you enjoy them, or did you just do them because you knew that, they were core subjects that would get you far in life?
I honestly actually really enjoyed economics. I think a lot of the topics, especially from a macro perspective, have, helped me to understand the world that we live in today. Yeah. Obviously, you know, a lot of the topics, even inflation is a very big hot topic right now. And, we learned that back in college, and maths personally did not enjoy, but, you know, it was very much getting it through. Psychology was also a very interesting topic for me. Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to do a joint honours. I wanted to do economics and psychology at uni.
Oh, interesting.
But back then, it was quite hard to find a uni that was offering that. But again, even today, it's like psychology is such a, understanding human nature, understanding how people think, it can be used very easily in everyday life. So, very applicable and super interesting.
Nice, nice. And how did you do in your A-levels? Well, good, excellent, if you don't have to say.
Classic Asian. I got 2 A-stars and an A.
That's okay, you did great. And I suppose when you were deciding on where you wanted to go for university, when did that process start? And yeah, how did you kind of find your shortlist of places where you wanted to study?
Yeah, so I did look into potential unis that offered psychology and economics as a joint honours. Mm-hmm. And the only one that offered was Hull, which was like very far.
Yeah,
I just, you know, ended up cancelling that. And then I actually looked at doing econ and management, which is where we met.
We ended up doing.
And my first choice was actually Bristol. But believe it or not, I then found out later, everyone else in Southampton Uni, which is the uni we went to, were basically rejects from Bristol and tried to apply for econ and management, which apparently they were only accepting 15 people in that overall, in that joint honours. It was really, really competitive.
Oh, really? So you're trying to tell me your two A stars and one A wasn't good enough for
exactly.
Bristol?
I have no idea.
Bloody
I wrote them a letter.
Hell.
I was pretty, it was like my first sign of proper rejection and it was hard.
Yeah. But, so I suppose, yeah, let's unpack that. How did you feel about that on results day?
Is that when you get the... Was it on results day when you find out if you've been rejected?
I think so. Because you get the results and then you check UCAS, right? To see if you... Actually,
oh,
no.
I don't think
what,
it
so
is.
Did you get rejected before you even got your results?
No, because I think it was after. I don't know. It's such a long time ago.
No, it is because, you know, without going into it, I don't know if I did great.
What was your first choice?
My first choice was Nottingham.
Okay.
And Southampton was my backup choice as well.
Oh, so why?
But I'm pretty sure.
So you got rejected from Nottingham?
Yeah. So Nottingham wanted two A's and a B.
Okay.
I did four. I got two A's and two C's.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, you'd think two C's equals a B or whatever, but I'm not a mathematician. But yeah, no, I think, yeah, after you get your results, it's either on that day or pretty soon after UCAS updates. And so, even if it doesn't happen on that day, you must be thinking, all right, I've smashed it.
Yeah.
I've got two A stars and an A. So it must be even worse if it happens after. And it must be so unexpected.
Well, actually, I got two E stars and two A's. But I didn't count the A level because I dropped that. So,
yeah. No, I did four in second year.
I needed three in second year. So I didn't really count the first year. But actually, prior to that, I did apply to Oxford as well. Rejected from that. That's
more understandable than bloody Bristol, you know.
I think they only required three A's because at the time when I was doing my A levels, they just introduced the A star, so that wasn't even a thing before.
Mm.
So I have no idea. Maybe my personal statement was not strong enough, but you know, I wouldn't have met you.
this is true. All right, so you've smashed sixth form, and I suppose away from academics, did you enjoy school? Like, were you a social butterfly? What were you like as a person back then?
I think I was a lot shyer at school. College and uni is when I really came out of my shell. I probably was my most sociable at uni. Like, I was, you know, I knew everyone a bit like you. I think we were both quite sociable at uni. I was definitely more on the quiet side.
Okay. So that takes us nicely into uni. So you go to Southampton, we meet each other on the first day. Great university, by the way. Let's talk about, first week of university. So you're in a new place. Were there many people from Chandler's Ford at Southampton? Were you the only one? How did you find settling into, you know, this place with that 20,000 people?
Gosh, I don't even think about that first week. I haven't thought about it since.
I'm really
jogging my memory. I'm revealing our age now.
There
wasn't anyone else from my school or maybe from the college. I don't know. It was quite fresh.
Mm-hmm.
It was... honestly quite exciting because it wasn't as much of a new city like town for me. Obviously I was quite familiar with Southampton being from there, so I felt like I had a bit of an unfair advantage. But it was I was just really excited to meet people, and it was really exciting. I met some of my closest friends like literally on the first week, and I still some of my closest friends today. So,
and I suppose a question I have around all of that, so you know, you mentioned that you were quite quiet in school, and then you touched on the fact that, you know, by the end of uni you kind of knew everybody. What obviously you were excited to go to uni, you know, giving advice to anybody who's quiet and maybe wants to break out of their shell, what would you say to people? Do you know what it was about uni that brought you out, or was it just you making a conscious effort to join societies because I know you did dance, etc.?
Yeah.
What do you think it was, and advice for anybody listening?
Yeah, well, I think I went to, I think college was, I found like some really good friends in college, and that really helped me to kind of get out of my, you know,
shell.
Get out of my shell and become a lot more confident. And that was a great stepping stone. And then going into uni, just having that mindset of like, I was just excited to meet people. And I think, I agree. I think, societies and clubs are a really good way to get to know other people. And I was just really interested in many things. Like, I remember that, the fair when you sign
the
up?
The bun fight.
That was it, bun fight, yes.
Yeah.
I was just signing up to everything, like even the Rock Society.
Yeah.
I just remember there were just so many different societies and I was just, you know, trying everything really, as everyone should do when they're starting uni.
Yeah, I hear that. And yeah, in terms of university, you know, we'll get on to how well you did. How did you find the course? Did it live up to expectations? Did you think about potentially picking up psychology? You know, what was that experience like for you?
Didn't end up picking up psychology. Obviously, we did econ and management, and I really enjoyed the management side of things. I remember we had, I don't know if you were in this course where we did one, which was like business strategy.
Don't ask me about any courses I did at uni, because
I basically came in like hungover. She would come in like late.
Any future employers, I've matured a lot as a human being. So yeah, don't let her paint a bad picture of me. Do I remember business strategy? Honest answer, no.
I remember that being quite interesting, where we did like a case study analysis.
I definitely enjoyed management more than economics, though.
Yeah,
I will say that. I do remember that.
Just remember a lot of the economics topics being like really dry. Do you remember that statistic lady we had?
I don't remember a lot of it.
Monotonous.
But I just don't remember enjoying it. I don't know. It wasn't that I didn't find it applicable. It just didn't really capture me. I always think back to university and what I would have done differently. Honestly, nothing. But I think I would have done like history and management, because I really found history like really interesting, and that was something that I was passionate about. And the management aspect, yeah, I really enjoyed. Economics for me, like, as soon as you like miss a couple of classes and you don't know about the fourth derivative and the fifth derivative,
it just gets a bit long.
Do you know what I mean? You know what, I can say it now. I always looked up to you, you know, Belinda, Amy, the way you guys tackled the degree and like smashed it out the park. I suppose, you know, with the with the complex things we were learning, I suppose, how did you keep on top of everything? Was it just a case of, I'm going to dedicate, you know, an hour a day to make sure I'm on top of it? Were you a crammer at the end of the year? How did you kind of keep yourself on top of everything you were doing?
Well, in the first year and the second year, actually, I was, I joined the street dance society.
Yeah, I remember.
I don't know if you remember, but I was dancing a lot, and it got to a point where we had to do this big performance at the O2, and the lady that was like singing, and we were like her backup dancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she
oh, wow.
demanded so much time of us, to the point where like every spare time it had to be training. And so that was like a big battle trying to do that and studying. But I guess first year was a lot more chilled anyway. But honestly, so I stayed at home during uni. So I guess having my parents like cook for me was great. And if I felt like I wanted to kind of get away from the uni life, I would like drive home and just shut myself off from everything. But I definitely wasn't a crammer at the time. I've always been like over prep, you know, always prepare well in advance, like as I say,
preparing to fail.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
So I was always very much like, get on it early and try and revise. Like, I took my exams very seriously back then. I feel like the older I get, the opposite. I've become less, and I've become more of a crammer and like to work under pressure. But when I was younger,
definitely being more prepared.
Yeah, and probably taking myself too seriously.
Nice. And then obviously, you know that you're doing well at university. When do you start thinking beyond? So thinking about grad schemes, thinking about life after uni, like, did you do any internships in any of the summers? Did you do any extracurriculars away from dancing?
Yeah, so I ended up doing a summer internship at Mazars, which is a professional services firm, during my second year, or my summer in second year. With the intention of joining the grad scheme before. So I was already thinking about that and trying to get experience. And back then it wasn't so important, but I feel like right now work experience means way more than, you know, getting a degree or whatever.
What made you get? Well, sorry to jump in there. What made you want to do that internship in second year? Was that advice from your parents? Were you looking at your peers? What was it that inspired you? And did you do a lot of applications, or was it, I want Mazars, I'm going for Mazars? Like,
yeah. So many. No, I just did so many. I think for our course, for economics, it was either going to IB, like investment banking, or become an accountant.
I didn't do either.
I feel like a lot of people went they one did or though, the
they
other,
did
right?
though, they did though, yeah, yeah.
But then
yeah,
again,
yeah.
you, yeah.
A
you
lot of people it. Have got really good jobs, or they've gone into like underwriting, which is
yeah,
accounting.
Which is
kind.
Insurance, yeah. I guess, finance in a way. Yeah. So it was either like IB, a lot of people went into IB, or accounting. I knew I didn't want to do investment banking. Mm. So I guess like, I joined an audit. I joined the audit department when I first started.
Mm.
Massive mistake, hated it. But I felt at the time it would have been a great kind of all-rounder to understand business. And it was a great bedrock to, you know, understand how businesses are run and get a great foundation.
Okay, great, great. And then that summer internship that you did. So I've had people on the pod before and they're speaking about internships and they said, yeah, it is some coffee getting. Yeah, it is, you know, note taking. Like, what was your experience like? What did you actually do, if you remember, when you were on your internship?
So mine was definitely not coffee taking. That was a lot of work.
Okay.
So basically, my role was to basically audit parish councils.
Oh my God. Okay.
So not interesting, but yeah, there was actually a lot of work to do. It wasn't hard, but there was just like sheer volume. But it was kind of a great flavor into, you know,
the working world.
Yeah, work life was.
And do you feel like what you were learning at the time in your degree helped you?
Absolutely
when you
not.
Were doing okay good
no
okay good all right so you do that in second year we go into third year you know I'm gonna give away the story karma smashes it out the water so when you complete your second year internship do you already know that you've got a job waiting for you or once again do you apply to loads of different places as you did for the internship what happens
I think you end up I did apply to a few others and then obviously you apply internally like through Mazars and I had to go up to London. I still had to kind of interview and do a full, can't remember what it's called, just like a day thing where they like...
Assessment day.
Yeah, assessment day where they make you do all these team working exercises and stuff.
Mm.
And then I got the offer after. So I did get an offer before graduating, I think, I believe.
Nice, that's good.
Yeah.
That must have been a big weight off your shoulders.
Yeah, it was. I do remember very vaguely.
Was it conditional or unconditional? As in conditional and getting like a 2-1 the first?
Honestly, I really can't remember.
Okay,
like
fair.
I
that's us showing our age.
Yeah, I can't remember any of this. But I do remember panicking a lot. I remember one night, and I still remember this night, like crying to my mum being like, I'm never going to find a job.
Really?
I don't know why. Yeah, because I applied to quite a few grad schemes and they're actually quite competitive.
Yeah, I mean,
like they're really competitive.
That's life.
And I actually wanted to do management consulting. I didn't want to do audit. And I applied to, I remember like Capgemini, like KPMG and didn't get a place in those in the Big Four.
Yeah.
And so I felt like, yeah, just
what so if I don't get a place in the Big Four, there's no point doing it. Was that...
I know, but I think there were like two or three failures and I think at the time I was like, this is like really hard, I'm not gonna get anything and then
That's true, but I think, you know, speaking to you, you've already showed your resilience in you know, not getting into Bristol and look, you kept your head up, you got to Southampton, you smashed it out of the park, you know, I hope you don't mind me saying, I'm pretty sure you got a first class. You probably got a first.
Just about.
Yeah, but hey, first is first. I'll tell you what, second is, it could be many things. So just be happy you got a first class. Okay, and then, so let's say we finish uni June.
Mm.
You've got your job. When does it start? Do you have time off? Do you have time to like go traveling, do what you want? Or is it, bang, we finish June, July, I'm into my new job in London.
Yeah. Pretty much started in August, so we went had like a month, a month break, and then moved to London.
Okay, great. And like you said, you started working for Mazars. We can bleep that out if you want. What was your first job title?
What was my job title?
I can go on LinkedIn and check this.
I know, but I don't think I even changed it changed every year, right? Because it was a 3-year grad scheme.
Okay,
and I joined as a graduate, so it would have been like graduate trainee or like audit.
And it was specializing in audit.
Yeah, so I specialized in audit.
A 3-year grad scheme.
Yeah, it's 3 years.
A lot of grad schemes, yeah, aren't there, like typically 2 years.
Well, I was training to be a qualified accountant, so I basically did the exams on the go as well. So you're training, okay, you were doing the exams part-time.
ACA or ACCA?
ACA, yeah.
ACA?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And because you're on the grad scheme, they pay for that, right?
Yes.
But yeah, is it one of those things for anybody listening who potentially wants to go on a grad scheme, because they pay for it, you have to stay there for a certain amount,
yes,
of time?
Yes, exactly.
Right?
So basically, if you fail your exam, I think it's the second time they fire you.
Oh my God, they like, fire you?
Really brutal, yeah.
Oh my
God. So like the fear you should have seen in my other colleagues, like my cohort.
Yeah, your cohort.
Like every time, I don't think my heart has ever beated so fast when getting those results. So yeah, basically how it works with ACA, your results come out at 12 p.m. and you find it online. So it's like public, so everyone can see. And if your name is not on that list, it means you failed.
Oh my God.
It's like the worst feeling, and you do that 15 times. And so... yeah, if you fail the second time, you get fired. But if you quit, then you have to pay back all of the
money,
college fees, the books and the training. And so basically no one quits unless they really, really like hate it.
And so is it, for those listening once again, you mentioned that there's 15 exams.
Mm.
Do you have autonomy in picking when those exams are? Or is it like six at the end of the first summer, six at the end of the second, three? Or you can choose to do two, you know, at Jan?
Yeah.
Free, like how has it
from
work?
What I remember, I think it was set, like everyone, okay, pretty much. Actually, I think typically because you have to go to college together, and so once you've kind of studied, you want to do your exams quite quickly after the I guess the college sessions, right? And once you've learned at that specific topic, and so but there are other sittings throughout the year,
okay,
but
cool,
typically you do kind of do them all together. As a group.
And how did you find doing the grad scheme and balancing getting that qualification? Was it a lot of hard yards having to be put? And like you mentioned, yeah, going to college, were you getting given like work days where you could go to college, or was it after work you were going to these classes?
Luckily, we could go to college during the day. So there would be like, you know, 2 weeks off where we would be working. We'd just go to college like it'd be like 9 to 4. Which is actually quite nice because I can't imagine going to college after work.
Mm-hmm.
Just exhausting, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
your
I can imagine.
Mind is just tired. So we were very lucky that we could do it.
How big was your cohort?
Maybe like 30 of us. Yeah.
And how did you enjoy the 3 years, the grad scheme? Would you recommend it?
I don't think I would do it again if I could go back.
Okay.
But
what would you do?
I don't know.
Sorry, I'm putting
it's so hard because after I qualified, I was like, oh wow, really, is this it? Am I just going to continue like all of that for nothing? Not for nothing. Like your salary doubles and, you know.
Doubles?
Yeah, pretty much after you've qualified. But
jeez.
Yeah, like for me, I knew I didn't want to stay in audit. So I actually did an internal transfer, moved into management consulting within Mazars, and then ended up being on Clydesdale Bank in Glasgow. And had to commute from London to Glasgow every week. So I was basically waking up at 4 a.m. on Monday mornings every week, getting a plane from London to Glasgow. And it was like, honestly, the worst time of my life.
Why didn't you just live there?
Because I just didn't want to spend the weekends there. No, okay, I don't know.
It was not a lot to do there.
Yeah, there wasn't much to do. Fair. It was also winter, so I didn't see like any sunlight. It's a bad time.
I can see the pain in your face.
You were definitely, that's when we went out a lot and it was bad times. And like, I needed a change.
Okay, and let's take it back a little bit. So you said that you got the internal transfer into management consultancy. You touched upon wanting to be a management consultant before and applying for that. What is it about management consultancy that you were attracted to? Is it like your skill set? What is it about that, I suppose, that people should be thinking about if they want to get into management consultancy?
Yeah, well, I guess like audit is very backward looking. So the way audit works is you're literally analysing financial statements that are already
Make sure they ain't done nothing too bookie, innit?
Yeah, exactly.
Making sure the money's...
So you're basically going, you know, zooming into each line of the balance sheet, the profit and loss. And, you know, say for example, you've got revenue on the profit and loss, you're zooming in to see that number that says revenue, 5 million, is actually meant to be 5 million. And so then you look at the breakdown of the 5 million, like what is that made up of? You get contracts and supporting documentation. So it's a lot of kind of cross-checking and... Yeah, you're not really
doing anything. It's just
adding that much value. It's not forward thinking.
Yeah,
and so in my mind at the time, I felt like management consulting, like you're really helping to make change or, you know.
Depends where, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It really, I think in my mind, I didn't really know what it was. And I thought that I could be of much more value and be able to consult, I guess, and be part of the decision making in terms of strategy for business models, etc. But often with big management consulting firms is, you know, you are just such a small cog in a big wheel. So like when I was on Clydesdale Bank, I was literally, I remember one week we were looking at FAQs on the website and we had to like review the FAQs to see that it made sense. Like this is so dry. Like, you know, I think maybe working with a startup might be more interesting.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I had really big clients. So
yeah. How long did you do the management consultancy at Mazars for?
Gosh, can't remember now. It's
just ballpark it.
Yeah, maybe just under a year. I don't think I stayed that long.
Okay, cool.
Because I ended up quitting that and then went traveling to South America on my own.
We'll get into that. Did you prefer the management consultancy to the auditing at least? or is it just like bloody hell?
I think it's hard because I spent a lot of my time in Glasgow, so I feel like it had like a. It wasn't a fair
that tarnished it.
Yeah, I think with management consulting, it really depends who your clients are.
Yeah,
and like who you work with. It's so hit and miss. It's just like pot luck, really.
Mm-hmm. So okay, so you say you do that for a year. How long did you go traveling for?
About just over 3 months.
And was that something that was kind of spur of the moment? Was it something that you always wanted to do, or was there like? I suppose I don't want to ask too deep. Like, was there like a reason that you were like, I'm going to go at this time?
Yeah, I think I'd always wanted to go to South America. I wanted to travel with a friend. It was more of a fantasy more than anything. And just like a bucket list thing that never really materialized. And during the time that I was working in management consulting, from a personal perspective, I really was not happy in life. My parents had split quite recently around that time. I also found it very, you know, at the time that my boyfriend was cheating on me, emotionally cheating, which was kind of worse. And I was basically like the only good, not sounds kind of sad, but I was very much living for the weekends and I was using like music and nightlife as a bit of an escapism. And I knew that was not sustainable. And I was always just searching for some sort of like, escapism in a way. And I essentially wasn't doing what I loved. And I feel like a lot of people can do a job that they don't love. But it was like too loud for me to ignore.
I think I
just needed to do a break and do a bit of soul searching. So yeah, it was a very kind of spontaneous decision to go, but I had the best time and it was a very transformative experience.
I love that. Well, you know that this used to be a travel podcast, so
yes.
I have to take the time to ask, where did you travel in the 3 months that you were away?
So I flew from London to Peru, to Lima. I did Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil.
And where was your favourite place?
I really liked Bolivia. I don't know if you're familiar with the salt flats, but honestly, like, it's just like heaven on earth. Like, if you Google pictures,
it sounds
like
salty.
Amazing. It's weird. It's kind of, you know, you have these salt flats that you had, and the reflection of the sky, you know, it's just reflected on the whole flats, and it's just beautiful. It feels like you're in heaven. And never seen anything quite like it. But,
and question I should have asked you at the start of the pod, which I asked everyone, you went traveling, what was the first thing you packed?
First thing I packed? Oh my gosh.
Or what's the first thing that you packed if you're going on a holiday now?
My phone, I guess.
Oh my god, what an answer.
I mean, how else are you going to go around without your phone?
This is true. We've had passport, we've had boxes.
Oh yeah, passport, of course. The obvious things. Yeah, maybe a non-assuming item would be my journal.
Okay.
Yeah, that
nice.
Was like a real, like, I could not live without my journal.
Okay, great. Yeah, I like that one. Journal. All right, I'm feeling that. Okay, Bolivia was your favourite place. You did that for 3 months. I suppose just before we move on from this, to anybody who wants to get away and travel, I mean, I suppose it's an obvious answer, but what would you say to them? What advice would you give to anybody who isn't happy in their job and is looking to, kind of get away?
I think travel is always a good idea. I think trying to, if anyone has never traveled on their own, I really advise.
How did you plan the trip? Any apps?
Spreadsheets.
Excel.
Like a 10-tab spreadsheet. Okay. Yeah. Nice. I ended up speaking to a lot of people who'd been already and was getting a lot of advice. I did a lot of research because I was going on my own. And back then, it wasn't that long ago, but back then, you know, I didn't really have much internet. And so South America is actually quite difficult to travel around. It's not like Southeast Asia, and it's quite expensive.
Oh, okay.
And so often it's more convenient to take these like long bus journeys to get from each country. Mm-hmm. And so there was just like so much downtime. And you really do have to plan ahead to get like to fit in as much as possible within a short space of time.
That's great. So the advice I'm taking there is plan ahead. There isn't too much internet.
Mm-hmm.
And then just enjoy.
But I don't know. It might be different now traveling in South America. This is a while ago.
Better to be overprepared.
I had planned a lot, but when I got there, I was open to diverting. Doing. Yeah, like I had planned to be in Buenos Aires for 3 days, ended up staying for 9. Like,
oh, wow.
I did kind of, you know, it was great to plan, so you're like, you go in informed, but then leaving it flexible because you meet so many interesting people and you might want to extend something.
And then as a female traveling alone, like, what was that experience like? Were you scared?
Not really, weirdly. Okay, great, now great. I look back, I'm like, why was I not scared?
Yeah.
No, I think the excitement just overrode the fear of, you know, the unknown kind of thing. And I was just so excited.
And then kind of jumping ahead, like, you've had some really like interesting jobs that you kind of highlighted before. Do you feel like the traveling experience is something that you've spoken about in the interviews after coming back from traveling, and it's something that, you know, recruiters or employers have looked at and been like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
Tell me more. And, you know, you've spoken about it before.
I think when I, after the South American stint, I definitely did share that experience. Obviously, I'd taken a bit of a sabbatical and come back to look for a new role. So that was, you know, something, it was like top of mind.
Mm.
But since then, not really, no.
Okay.
But I think for that specific one then, yeah.
And so where is it you end up next? It takes us nicely.
I ended up working for a global creative agency as the FC. So
FC stands for?
Financial controller.
Okay.
So ended up joining a creative kind of space, but still stayed within finance.
And what does a financial controller do for anybody listening?
I mean, the job title can be misleading. It really depends on the company. But for me, I was basically a business partner to the MDs. There were a couple of agencies that I was looking after, one in London, one in Amsterdam. And I was basically the business partner to the MD. So, you know, looking after all areas of obviously profit. But I was like 25 at the time, so I was still quite young, but I felt like it gave me such an amazing exposure in terms of understanding like people, product and profit, of course.
Mm.
And I mean, looking back, I definitely felt like I had imposter syndrome because even though I was in finance before, as I mentioned before, audit's very backwards looking, whereas... as an FC in this role, it was very much forward looking. So using the management accounts, and you were helping to tell a story with the numbers and to help the MDs make the right decisions in the business to drive, you know, revenue forward. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of responsibility. And I remember sitting in these boardroom meetings of like, you know, men in their late 40s, and just there like, okay, I just pretend like I know what I'm talking about. Mm. I mean, I did, but you do feel there is like a sense of intimidation in a way. But yeah, honestly, it was a really steep learning curve, and I'm really thankful for that experience.
This sounds amazing. I've got two questions which are screaming out to me. The first question on that is, how do you combat the imposter syndrome?
Mm.
So like, are you taking courses, self-learning, speaking to people? What is it you did to help combat that
It was quite difficult to take courses because, you know, technically I've done the ACA, and but, you know, a lot of the exams you do, you just forget about everything. Like, there's so many, you know, there's so much that
just
you
learning
learn
for learning
in the 3 years.
Yeah.
And you don't actually apply it as much. Especially not in audit anyway, as in, like I said before, it's backward looking. So actually the ACCA, or is it the CIMA, is more applicable for, so most people end up being management accountants, go through the CIMA route, which is a lot more applicable. Because I didn't take those exams, I took ACA. It was slightly different, and there were gaps in my knowledge.
So how do you plug the gaps then? Just by doing?
Yeah, just by doing, really. Obviously asking questions. I ended up working a lot of hours. I was just speaking to a lot of people and trying to understand the business better, mm-hmm. And trying to understand the business model, like what are the major risks in the company. Mm-hmm. I guess the question that I was always asking myself is, how can I add value to this person? Mm. Like, how am I going to be a useful person? How can I add value? And so value can come in many different forms, mm-hmm. and manners. I think it was very much just trying to... Yeah, just be of service in a way.
Yeah, that's great. I think the key takeaway there is, yeah, that question to yourself, how can I add value to people? Mm-hmm. And then more difficult one, and I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this, but I'm going to put you on the spot anyway. You know, we've spoken about some of the difficulties you had in the past with the rejections. I suppose in this role, especially where you're doing the forward planning, mm-hmm. and advising people, did you ever get it wrong? And if you did, how did you learn from that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, with like management accounts, there's always so many like
there's always things,
chances
there's always...
for error, right? Mm. It's impossible to get everything completely 100% right. But I remember one time because I had like the Excel spreadsheet which had all the salaries, one time accidentally sent that spreadsheet, which was unprotected, to a bunch of the board members.
Oh wow.
And obviously was like freaking out, and you know, obviously very sensitive information. Mm. Luckily it was like a version 2 and a lot of the salaries were missing, so not a lot kind of leaked out. But then I just, you know, made it a conscious effort to make sure that, you know, I had strict SOPs and was like making sure that I've double checked that everything is, you know, password protected before sending it out. Mm. But yeah, there were so many stories like within the finance team where it was a very easy mistake to do, mm-hmm. because you're sending so many spreadsheets via emails, etc. And yeah, it's not like back then we didn't have, you know, like Slack. I mean, I'm sure Slack was around, but people were still working with emails. Right? Yeah. Whereas now, if you did that, you could quickly delete it.
Yeah, undo it.
So
I feel you.
Yeah, back then it was very much email focused.
Okay, that takes us to the end. Did you have any promotions within this role? Or were you the same? And how long did you do it for?
Yeah, so not so much a promotion, but I ended up moving to Singapore. Like Iris took me to Singapore.
Okay.
To cover someone on maternity leave. So okay. Initially, I remember my COO calling me from New York one day and he was like, "Hey, Carmen, like, what do you think of Singapore?" And never been before, didn't know much about it. I was like...
Hot.
Yeah, humid. And it's funny, literally the month before, maybe it was even the same month, I had gone on a trip to Sri Lanka. Mm. Loved the place. Not similar to Singapore, but obviously a very, you know, exotic kind of tropical country.
It's a different culture.
Yeah, different culture, of course. But yeah. I was like, okay, you could get used to this heat, you know. Mm. You know, big difference to London in terms of weather. And so... Yeah, I obviously jumped at the chance and moved out with the intention of staying there for 6 months.
Oh, wow. It was only 6 months.
Yeah, initially it was meant to be because I was meant to just cover someone mm-hmm. on maternity leave.
So. Yeah, so you did that for 6 months. So many questions to unpack here. How did you enjoy the 6 months?
I loved it. Yeah, I, again, used that opportunity to travel a lot within the region because in my mind I thought I was going to be there for 6 months, so... my main priority was just travel. Prior to actually moving to Singapore, I got really into startups. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was conceptualizing my own podcast at the time, which was called the Another Startup Story podcast, which was very much just interviewing a lot of entrepreneurs, founders, people who are doing interesting things and trying to understand their kind of success and failure stories. Back then, it wasn't as common. Like now, I think there's tons of like entrepreneurship podcasts. Like
ahead of the curve.
Yeah, back then, I remember asking my my founder and CEO to interview him, and I was so nervous. And I literally come up with the idea like a week before, and I just emailed him because I knew I was leaving very shortly. So I was like, "Would you be interested to? I'm starting a podcast." Didn't even have a name for it or anything, and he was like, "Yeah, let's do it tomorrow." I was like, tomorrow. So I remember that night just quickly like coming up with some questions, and we sat outside in London Bridge, and I brought my phone out, like really not high tech, not as fancy, and in a high production, not in a podcast studio or anything. Mm. And I just literally recorded it on my phone. I remember it being a really hot day and my phone had blown up. It was like too hot. And
oh, my goodness.
Like, oh, wow. Towards the end. And I was so embarrassed. And he was like, it's fine. We could just redo it. I'm like, this guy is so busy. And I'm just going to ask him for another hour of his time.
Yeah.
But
how did you find it though? Did you get the bug after doing it that first time?
The bug of
recording podcasts?
Yeah, I mean, since then I've gone into I've interviewed a lot of really interesting people. I don't do it anymore. I paused after starting my current role just because I didn't have enough time.
Mm.
But it was mainly more so to allow me to extend my own network and to learn for myself, as opposed to trying to make it big and make it like a money making thing.
Yeah,
I look back and it was like a really amazing tool to keep me accountable
in
terms of learning and, you know, even just from personal development, not necessarily just entrepreneurship, but even wellness, like fitness, like, you know, spirituality, like so many different other areas of life, which just, you know, speaking to experts within their specific field was like really, really inspiring.
And so first of all, I just want to say I agree. And I'm similar in the sense that I do this podcast, and I haven't done it for a while, but I do this podcast to learn. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even always have to be like an expert in the field. It just has to be somebody who looks at things from their own perspective.
Mm.
So I think for me, the various topics we cover, it's just about understanding, you know, different perspectives, and that each perspective is okay. You know, that's kind of the basis of this podcast, right? It's like, you don't have to have gone to uni to be successful. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have taken this course. You don't have to have done that course. Everybody has their own unique journey.
Mm-hmm,
and it's just about picking people's brain and understanding why they did what they did. And then, seeing if it's worked out, if it's not worked out. And, just speaking about it. So, agreeing with you there. Coming back, so you're supposed to do Singapore for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
When you're prepping to move your life to another country, which is like 13, 14 hours away, what goes into that? Like, do you have to put everything into storage? Like, you have to pack your whole life up. You've got to get visas. Just talk me through everything that's going through your head at that time.
And
you know, is there any inkling where it's like, if this 6 months goes really well, I'm not coming back?
I was quite lucky because I was going there, obviously, with a job.
Mm.
So I wasn't moving
there. You had that security.
Like, and was like, oh, I need to find a job. Yeah, so the HR in Singapore were really, really, like, held my hand through everything. They sorted out my visa because it's quite difficult to sort out your visa in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, like, really attentive on that. But in terms of my stuff, I actually let go of my apartment. I was living in Stockwell in London at the time, not far from here, and ended up moving the rest of my stuff back to my parents.
Yeah.
And it's still there. So, it was relatively straightforward.
Okay, so spoiler alert, Carmen still lives in Singapore. It's what is
I
it?
Do,
five years later.
Four and a half. Well, 4 years. Since four, August, four, though. Sorry, 4 years.
I was 4 years.
4 years, yeah.
Okay, that's four rounded up to five.
3 months, yeah.
Okay. At what point in the 6 months do you know that, or do you make the decision that, okay, we're going to make this a permanent thing?
So actually it wasn't, so obviously coming up to the 6 months, my the manager that I was reporting into at the time, she was like the chief commercial director. She pulled me aside and said that they, you know, would I like to stay and that they would love to keep me here. At the time, I didn't feel ready to come back to London.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up staying, but I was also like brewing something else in the corner. Like, I knew I didn't want to stay at that company. Mm. But I knew I wanted to explore Asia more. I felt like I could make more impact there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in London, you are just like a small dot in the ocean.
Yeah,
really tough to, try
small
and make
fish in a big pond.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas in Asia, I just felt like I could make more impact. And that was what was on top of mind at the time.
I really feel that. And this might be a difficult question. When you make a decision like that, so I've thought about moving abroad in the past, and I know friends have thought about it, but I think some people are, I don't know, homebodies.
Yeah.
They're worried about, in new relationships, you know, leaving your friends behind. Obviously, you know, you're going through this. Was it in, I mean, I don't even know what to ask here. Was it an easy decision for you or for anybody who's potentially thinking of moving abroad and might be apprehensive?
Yeah.
What would be your advice to them?
I think it really depends on your phase of life, right? And what your priorities are. I was in my, you know, mid-20s and the priority for me was just to, you know, exploration and discovery. I wanted to learn and be inspired and I wanted to travel and that was like my main priority, really.
Yeah.
I wasn't ready to settle down and have kids. Still not ready to do that now. But like, I think my main priority in my mid-20s was just, yeah, exploration and discovery. And I think Asia was an amazing platform for me to do that. And it still is. I think COVID was obviously very unfortunate where, you know, we were
robbed you of 2 years.
Yeah. But, you know, there are other gains during the COVID process and you kind of find the silver lining and everything. But yeah, it really depends on, yeah, age and your priorities. Like, what do you want in life and what are your goals? So it's very...
Understand what you want in life.
Yeah, exactly.
And then based on that, you can make a decision on whether it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Like at the time, I wasn't in a relationship, so I didn't really have any commitments. You know, so I had the luxury of not having these commitments that I needed to be home for. So I say, I better do it now. You never know. Like as you get older, we have a lot more commitments and you're not as free to make these decisions anymore. So. Really just doing a cost-benefit analysis on your life and what it is
there it
that
is.
You're doing.
The cost-benefit analysis on your life. There's the clip from Commentating People. CBA. And what I will say and what I will say as well is, I mean, you can move abroad if you are in a relationship, but the decision is definitely easier when you don't have that commitment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned you get the permanent role, but you have something brewing in the corner. So how long is it that you're at that company? And then how do you transition into what you do next?
Yeah, it was a tough transition because...
Did you feel wedded to the company that brought you out there? Like, did you feel like I owe them something or no? It was like... No.
I did, but very quickly... Actually, so the company at the time...
We don't have to dish dirts, by the way.
No, no. Feel bad, but everyone at the company knows it. Basically, we were in the midst of being bought out by Chell, who are the guys who own Samsung.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not a surprise, but there were very, very tight revenue targets and KPIs that were being met. And so actually a lot of the leadership team left anyway.
Okay.
Like all the BDs, all the board directors were leaving because it was just like, it became very toxic and very focused on numbers. And so, yeah, the culture was not great at the time. So that was like very much more of an incentive for me to leave. And I remember coming into work one day and handing in my notice. And the MD at the time in Singapore, she was like, no, 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 I want you to stay and do a different role because I feel like your skill sets could be used elsewhere in the company. So I was like, okay, like, let's have a chat. So I ended up staying at the company doing a more of a marketing and BD role, which is kind of what I was doing on the side. So I basically was running like a media platform. So doing the podcast, producing a lot of content, doing ebooks, blogs around like the intersection of entrepreneurship and creativity. And so this was like, yeah, it was just like a great platform for like a lot of lifestyle and creative startups and, you know, solo entrepreneurs who didn't really know where to start or like wanted kind of like business advice or even freelancers. And so I was doing that on the side. And also trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I just didn't want to stay at the company. But it was a great kind of semi-transition where I was like having income coming in whilst also working on
what you wanted to do.
Yeah, what I wanted to do on the side. So, but it was tough because, yeah, I think going from the mindset of being an employee to like working for yourself, it's really hard because you have to rethink about the concept of how you see time. And so I was just... always thinking that I needed to work. I was like totally overburnt and working in my full-time job, but also working like in the evenings and on the weekends. And I never, I just felt like every second counts and that's not healthy, you know? But when you are working for yourself, sometimes, you know, at the beginning, when you're not used to it, it's really hard to kind of get out of the concept of, you know, like, rest and recovery is important. And it's not sustainable to keep going. To the point when I remember I was in Vietnam, I was with my mate Lou, we were at a festival in Phu Quoc, and I remember it was like New Year's Eve and I was thinking, I should be working. And Lou was like, God. You are mental. Like, you really need to, like, stop. And then that was, like, the big wake-up call. I was like, this is not normal. Like, I need to... Yeah, it's like, damaging my mental health. But it's a tough transition, especially when you're on your own doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right. And that pretty much almost brings us up to date.
Yeah, kind of. So I ended up obviously leaving Iris and then ended up working on my own consultancy for a couple of years. Another startup story through the pandemic. But the main goal of doing that was I wanted to travel and work remotely.
Yeah.
Remote work. This was before the pandemic. And I kind of wanted to live that digital nomad lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to scale the company in that regards. But then when the pandemic happened, I was like, okay, no digital nomad lifestyle.
Yeah, fact.
At home. And so actually I was like, look, you know what? I'm still young. Actually, I want to join a company because I don't want to have two options. I can either scale my company and grow it, or second, I can join a company and be part of a bigger momentum. Mm. So I chose the latter. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up in a crypto company.
Yeah. And once again, when you're looking for your new role, is it lots of applications? Were you targeted? How did you end up in this role?
Yeah. So actually it was through a recruiter. It was really unexpected and unassuming. So I had a recruiter reach out to me. It's like, do you have any experience in crypto? I was like, no. Not for me. Like, even though I felt like it was a really interesting topic, because I've always been interested in unconventional topics, anything that's kind of weird and not mainstream, I will, you know, gets my attention. And so I found that interesting, but obviously didn't have much experience in the space, so I was kind of like very resistant to it. And the recruiter just kept, he was just seemed to, I don't know, he just really wanted me to meet the CEO. So I did, and we had like a good 2 hour long conversation in like the first, you know, formal interview. Really interesting guy. And basically the role was the chief of staff role. And so he wanted me to essentially assist him. So anyone who doesn't know what chief of staff is, it's a bit like a, it's like not a PA, but it's like a, I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of, you're like the right-hand man to the CEO, right-hand woman to the CEO.
Yeah,
so you'd be helping them across a number of different aspects. It really depends on what are the most immediate needs and demands of the business at that current time. Mm-hmm. And so you really do learn so much, mm-hmm. you know, and it could be operational, marketing, strategy, even financial. And I'm sure like loads of chief of staffs have very unique specialisms. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like it was a good combination of my kind of weird transition where I've qualified in finance but also had this kind of marketing interest and had been working with a lot of startups to help them build their marketing and social media strategy. So that was really interesting. And so I ended up, it was a huge risk I think at the time. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of, you know, early mid 2021, mm-hmm. not that long ago, but this was definitely before the NFT boom. And I feel like Web3 has become a long, long way since, and it's almost become kind of mainstream in a way, but still. I don't know.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, you know. But it was a risk at the time,
before. Sure.
And so, that kind of brings us to date.
Okay, so this has been great. I mean, I don't know if I've spoken to anybody on the podcast who has had such a variety. So obviously you've
Jack
got the financial
trades, yeah.
But you know, I found out that saying, it's actually better to be the jack of all trades.
Who said that?
Oh my God, who was it? Somebody who I work with. He was explaining that the quote is actually misquoted, and it's part of a wider quote that I don't remember, so I can't say, but it's actually giving praise to the
put
fact
it in the
that
show notes.
to the fact that people, a person has the ability to do lots of things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But anyway, Carmen, this has been great. And I suppose just as we kind of come to the end, what is next for you? You know, you spoke about the pandemic and pivoting to working for an organization.
Mm-hmm.
you know, touch wood, it looks like the worst of the pandemic is over. With that in mind, hopefully, you know, your employers ain't listening. Like, do you see yourself going back to working for yourself now the world has come back to normal, or do you see yourself continuing to be an integral part of a company? Where do you see yourself in 5 years, I suppose?
Yeah, my main focus right now is to just really become, you know, expert in the Web3 space. I'm trying to, I feel like I'm always the dumbest person in the room when I go to these conferences, because these people are so like light years ahead and so experienced. And it's really, I've noticed that I am someone who needs to be in an environment where I'm learning loads. Otherwise I get really complacent and then I get depressed and bored. And so if I'm in a, like, crypto, Web3 is such an expanding industry and it's growing at such a fast pace that it keeps me on my toes. And so, yeah, I think for me, I'll continue to work for really smart, you know, and intellectual individuals and try and learn as much as possible. I think it's an amazing, well, you know, we're at a time now where there's been a huge intersect of like the arts and entertainment industry with finance and crypto, and that's like never before happened. And so it's really interesting. Finally, you can kind of bring all these like interesting areas of culture and interests. Like, I love music and seeing, I don't know if you know Blondish, she's like quite a famous DJ, but she's like really into crypto. Like, she speaks at Bitcoin conference, she's launched her own NFTs, and she's really like kind to trying to just disrupt the whole music industry, which really needs a new business model to try and, I guess, like give back the power to the actual artists who are recording and making the music themselves. And so very much bringing more ownership to these content creators and these artists out there. So it's a really interesting time that we're living in. And I feel like Web3 is still a very nascent space right now, but we've got like a long way to go. And yeah, it's just the beginning.
Audius is a crypto company that is looking to give back to artists as well.
So yeah. No, they're
I'm
great.
I'm sure that Blondish, you know, is very familiar with Audius.
She's done a lot of like AMAs on Reddit with Audius, I think. Yeah.
Okay, nice. Check it. Carmen, this has been a great chat. Thank you so much for coming on. Before I let you go, I don't know if you want to plug any socials where people can find you, if they want to learn more about you, the company you work for.
Yeah. No, thanks so much for having me. It's been great having this conversation with you. In terms of socials, you can find me on Instagram at tangcarmen and LinkedIn, I guess.
Yeah.
LinkedIn.
We can add it to
LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I don't know. We can LinkedIn add it. Or, I don't know. I feel like my Spotify playlist is more interesting than anything.
I don't know if you want people. Yeah, find it on Spotify.
Yeah, no. But Instagram, I guess. Or, yeah, I don't really use Facebook anymore.
Instagram it is. And guys, yeah, for those of you who have made it to this point in the show, yeah, please once again make sure you're following the podcast at Vibes and Tribes. Like I said, you know, we slacked off for a while, but we got a lot of juicy episodes coming. So yeah, Carmen, once again, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. It's been Vibes and Tribes, over and out.
Thanks so much for having me.